This is an ABC podcast.
Fata alofa atu, hello lingeta, and good morning. I'm Agnes DuBois, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, broadcasting across the Pacific region. Today we want to acknowledge that the 25th of April is a pivotal moment in history, marking the anniversary of the Anzac forces landing at Gallipoli during the First World War. Dawn services are being held across Australia and much of the Pacific region to pay tribute to soldiers who've served their country on the battlefields of war. This is a poignant reminder to honour and reflect upon the sacrifices made by our servicemen and women, lest we forget. On the show today, how are the Pacific celebrating Anzac today? And it was Solomon Islands elections last week, but none of the parties emerged from that were strong enough to form a government on their own. So where to from here? And there's a dengue outbreak that's been declared in Samoa. More on those stories shortly. Find us on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. Like and follow us there, or type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine to find these stories. We appreciate your company. I'm Aggie DuBois, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start in Papua New Guinea, where the Prime Ministers of Australia and PNG have taken part in an Anzac Dawn service in the town of Isurawa. The morning's service marks the end of a two-day trek along the infamous Kokoda Trail, where the two Prime Ministers paid tribute to those who died in the battlefields of the Second World War. The ABC's Melissa Clark with the story.
The Kokoda Track is known for being arduous. The steep hills, the humidity and the mud make trekking here a serious undertaking. Over 2 days, Anthony Albanese and James Marape have walked together, taking time to catch their breath, talk, and remember the soldiers who walked this track 82 years ago in a devastating wartime battle to push back the advancing Japanese soldiers.
What we have done over the past couple of days is get just a small insight of the courage and resilience.
From village to village, the arrival of two prime ministers has been heralded. And after a final push, the leaders reached the Isurawa Memorial Site, meeting the Australians and Papuans who've gathered here for an Anzac Day dawn service. A crescendo to a journey.
The journey up was hard. It's not easy, not a walk in the park, so to speak, in any case. But what we're doing today symbolises that we can't take the present for granted. We too must plant our own memories, the memories of democracy, respecting each other, caring for each other.
We walk together today and into the future as well.
This journey has cemented the personal relationship between the two leaders. And for the Australian government, having Papua New Guinea as a firm and reliable partner is a reassurance in a world of uncertainty.
And that is ABC's Melissa Clark reporting from the Kokoda Trail in Papua New Guinea. Staying in Papua New Guinea, more than 200,000 soldiers died there during the fighting of the Second World War. And for Australians, the trek by the diggers along the infamous Kokoda Trail is forever etched into the country's military history. Joining us this morning to talk more about the PNG's role in World War II is battlefield historian, author and television presenter Matt McLaughlin. With that I say, Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Aggie. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate your time this morning. Do you think it's a fitting way, though, to mark Anzac Day with both Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and James Marape walking the Kokoda Trail?
I think it's very appropriate, quite unexpected as well. It's a tough trek, so it's an impressive thing to see. And the Kokoda Trail is an iconic representation of Australian sacrifice on Anzac Day, and also that relationship between us and PNG. So I think it's a really great thing to see.
So what strategic importance did PNG play in the Second World War? I mean, why was it so desperately fought over?
Well, we actually misunderstand the New Guinea campaign in some ways in the Second World War, because it's usually painted as the last step before the Japanese invaded Australia. And the concept is that Japan was moving through Asia, the Pacific, and it was next stop Australia in terms of invasion. That's not quite the case. What the Japanese were doing is they were trying to separate Australia from the USA by capturing important islands in the Pacific, and that included the Solomon Islands, PNG, and then eventually, had that succeeded, they were going to move down and capture Fiji and Vanuatu and New Caledonia. So the plan was to separate Australia from America so that Japan could secure its conquests in Asia and the Pacific. And so by the time they arrived in Papua New Guinea, it was very important that we stop them in that ambition.
Mm. I must say, yeah, what made the PNG people so valuable to its success?
Well, the people of PNG were absolutely vital. In fact, people across the Pacific, wherever there was fighting, in Solomon Islands as well, the local people were very important, all the way up, back up through the Philippines and all the way up into Asia. Local people provided absolutely essential assistance to the fighting troops, and we never would have achieved victory without them, because they knew the terrain, they assisted by carrying in supplies, they carried out wounded people. It was a campaign that really was fought in conjunction with the local people for the liberation of those islands. So we never would have won a victory in the Pacific without the local people.
Which leads me to ask, Matt, how big of a price did PNG soldiers pay during that battle?
Well, it was a huge price that they paid. So there were not just local people, but also, as you say, soldiers as well fighting against the Japanese. And of course, the areas where the Japanese had captured were effectively under occupation, the same way as we think about occupation in Europe. The islands of the Pacific came under occupation. And I've spent a lot of time in PNG and Solomon Islands and both those places. I've spoken to older people who recall the situation as children, and it was really quite horrific having the Japanese come in, take over, securing their villages and taking their food, and in many cases forcing them to work. So both the local people and those who put on a uniform and fought against the Japanese had a tough war.
Yeah, Matt, we hear so much about the Kokoda Trek. You know, Kokoda gets much of the glory. But I know other battles were fought also. I mean, Milne Bay comes to mind. I mean, how do they shape the outcome?
Yeah, the fighting carried on for a very long time in New Guinea, long after Kokoda was over. There was a lot of fighting in New Guinea to drive the Japanese out. And you mentioned Milne Bay. That was an early battle, which actually marked the first time the Japanese were defeated on land in the Second World War. And so an Australian force came in. They were building airfields in Milne Bay on the eastern tip of Papua New Guinea. And the Japanese landed to try and capture those airfields. And the Australians fought a great battle, which resulted in the defeat of the Japanese. And the Japanese had to get back on their boats and leave. And that was the first time the Japanese had been defeated on land. So there's just this iconic history in PNG associated with particularly the Australian efforts against the Japanese. And I think it's cemented the relationship between the two countries forever.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in to Pacific Beat, I'm your host, Aggie Tobol. I am speaking to Matt McLaughlin about PNG's role in World War II. He is a battlefield historian, author, and television presenter. Matt, if we, we reported this week of a plan to install more memorials around Port Moresby to extend wartime tourism even beyond the trail. What kind of installments or museums would you like to see?
It's an interesting one, because we're seeing this quite a bit around the Pacific and indeed around the world, that building more memorials. I think it's a really good thing. I think it helps focus visitors. When tourists do come over to walk this ground, it gives them a focus on what went on in various places. But it's also important for local people as well to know what went on, and that certainly seems to be what's happening in PNG. And again, with my experience in PNG and Solomon Islands, I recall that 10 or 15 years ago, the opening of the memorial in Honiara to the coast watchers and the Solomon scouts who did such great work in the Second World War. And that was a wonderful tribute to the local people, and a lot of local people turned up for the opening of that memorial. And it's still a focal point for local people about the war. So I hope that it continues in that way in PNG, that memorials are not just for overseas tourists, but also something the local people can be proud of.
Absolutely. And I do just quickly want to ask, Matt, if someone was to walk the Kokoda Trail, what are people expecting as they make that trek?
Be fit is what I would say. It's a it's a challenge. Do your training beforehand. It's considered the toughest sea level trek in the world. So it's people do get into serious trouble and occasionally die on the track. So I don't want to scare anyone off, but make sure you're prepared for it physically and mentally, because it's a long trek. It usually takes 10 or 11 days, and it's grueling. But incredibly rewarding to walk that ground where the Australians walked and to see those sites where so many of them died. So I'd certainly recommend it if you're fit, but certainly do your training first.
Absolutely. Matt, look, we really appreciate your time and just giving us a little bit of insight into this. Hopefully we can catch up again, but appreciate your time.
Thanks, Aggie.
No worries. That is battlefield historian, author and television presenter Matt McLaughlin here on Pacific Beat. Now, an intense period of political horse trading is about to get underway in Solomon Islands after none of the parties emerged from last week's elections were strong enough to form a government on their own. The incumbent pro-Chinese Prime Minister, Manase Songavare, leads a crowded pack, even though his party lost more than half its seats. From Honiara, here's the ABC's Solomon Islands reporter, Chris Narita Almanuliong.
On the streets in Solomon Islands' capital, Honiara, there's one question on everyone's mind.
So who do you think will be the country's next prime minister?
I like Gordon Dasi, Lilo. I want him to become a prime minister.
Me, Junior Peter Ken Lorena should be our next prime minister for Solomon Islands.
After a week of counting, all 50 seats in Solomon Islands' national election have been declared. No party has gained a clear majority, but caretaker Prime Minister Manase Songavare has emerged with 15 seats, the largest number. But that's half of the 37 seats his party had coming into the election.
Obviously, there is a big, big interest by the world, because there have been a number of decisions that have not gone down well within the international community, especially the Western allies, led by the United States of America, Australia, New Zealand.
Mr. Songavare has led Solomon Islands through 5 years of rapid change, most notably pulling the country closer towards China. As competition for influence in the Pacific region intensifies, it has meant the election is being closely watched by Australia and the superpowers. In an interview with local media, Mr. Songavare even went as far as to accuse the United States of interfering in the election in his home province, claiming the U.S. embassy promised to pay the school fees of people who voted for his rival.
United States of America.
I'm going to write to the United States of America, the U.S. Embassy. Our people, the people who voted for me, we won. They're saying, let them pay for these voters. You look after us.
Today marks the start of an intense negotiation period that could take weeks, with parties and independents horse trading to try and build a coalition and form government. And it's a crowded pack, with opposition leader Matthew Wale and Peter Kenilore Jr., the son of the country's first prime minister, seen as possible potential rivals to Mr. Songavare. Both men have committed to review the country's pivot towards China. Yet one man, former Prime Minister Gordon Dasi Lilo, has emerged as a dark horse after returning to Parliament.
I have been Prime Minister before. I was never selfish about it. I love this country and I want this country to progress more.
Election watchers say last week's elections was clean and peaceful. But the negotiation process to build government has historically seen accusations of corruption and under-the-table payments. Veteran journalist Dorothy Wickham says surprises are expected.
There were already certain MPs being seen at certain camps that didn't belong there before. So I think that there's already some movement. With the elections for the Prime Minister, it's secret ballot. You can just swing anywhere at the last minute.
11 independent MPs were elected and they're expected to play a crucial role in forming government.
Solomon Islands reporter Chris Narita Almanuliong there. And the US Embassy in Solomon Islands has been contacted for comment about Mr. Songavari's claim. To communities in Palau who are eagerly awaiting the remains of their ancestors who were held in German institutions for over a century. The eight ancestors were taken without their community's knowledge and kept in a museum and a university in Germany for about 100 years. A handover ceremony took place recently. They were part of a wider collection of thousands of human remains from the Pacific region, kept in museums and university collections since colonial times. Dubrovka Volodia reports.
Sitting on shelves in storage rooms, boxes containing human skulls had been kept in darkness for years. Eight of those remains held in the boxes at the University of Göttingen and State Ethnographic Collections of Saxony have been handed over to their descendants from Palau. Göttingen University's president, Professor Metin Tolan, spoke at the handover ceremony in his city.
Please accept our apologies for what was done to your ancestors.
Leontine Meyer van Mensch from the State Ethnographic Collections of Saxony also spoke.
Today we are gathered in the spirit of humanity. Today we are gathered because we as university and museum collection need to take responsibility for the wrongdoings in the past. We are gathered in the painful truth that we should have needed together, and that we as institutions and the responsible political bodies have taken too much time to take that responsibility.
The skulls came to Germany in colonial times, but until recently, the descendants did not know they were there.
When I first heard about it, I was really shocked because I just couldn't wrap my head around the fact that people were brought there. When we got there, I was also surprised at how apologetic most of the people were, because this was like over 100 years ago.
Ripka Quintaro is a representative of the Puluana Council in Palau who attended the ceremony. Four of her ancestors were taken.
When I actually stood up and did the whole chant, it was, I got so emotional. I didn't even realize it. I was shocked at myself too. I hope that at least they are now at peace, just and that we could bring them back home.
She says there was no knowledge in her community about what had happened about 100 years ago.
And so there was never any, no idea whatsoever, or even like a hint that such things could have happened or did happen, nothing.
A couple of years ago, Palauan McMichael Mutok Jr. went to Germany on a fellowship to learn what was in the boxes. Not much was known about the skulls, where they exactly came from, or how exactly they got to Europe. But he's since learned more.
It's of our ancestor remains has a number that's written on the skulls that actually associated with the index cards. And the index cards mention about Palau. So there were, you would say, a journal entry written by Dr. Paul Hambrook, who visited Palau in 1908. And he's one of the explorer who joined with Dr. Augustin Kramer on the South Seas expedition. And on his journals, he actually mentioned about collecting human remains in Palau.
And they were obviously stolen remains.
Yeah, it was written exactly on his journals that he went there secretly just to excavate the remains.
The skulls were later used in race research, an outdated and now condemned practice. Mr. Mutok says it's Palau's first repatriation of human remains from colonial times. He's since been contacted by some other German museums and an institution in the United States who also have remains from Palau. Professor of Cultural Anthropology at the University of Göttingen, Regina Bendix, says there's a big push in Germany to deal with its colonial past.
There's a really a big sea change in being able to talk with concerned communities being able to exchange information, trying to work together to make it possible to restitute if the interest is there.
This was the university's third repatriation to the Pacific. Earlier, they held ceremonies for Hawaiian as well as Maori and Moriroi remains. While scientists know that the remains are from Palau, they will for the first time use DNA technology to see if they can find any direct living descendants.
Measuring skulls is, of course, this horrible historical, you know, the phrenology, the effort to come to race science in the 19th century. But the DNA is, of course, an opportunity.
The remains will go on a journey across the world to their home soon. Ripka Quintaro says they will be welcomed by their communities.
To have them back and giving them a proper burial is very important to us. It's all woven into everything that identifies us as people of Puloana and then Palau.
They are expected to arrive next month, and the Palau government plans to erect a memorial at their burial site.
And that's Dubravka Volodya. Now, if communities are worried that their ancestors are in overseas institutions, they are encouraged to get in touch with German authorities. We will leave details once the report has been posted online.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thubal. Well, there's a long-running legal battle between an Australian High Court judge and the Kiribati government, and that could be coming to a close soon. A tribunal report recommending the dismissal of suspended Judge David Lambourne has been tabled in Parliament and will be debated today. There are fears Mr. Lambourne, who is married to a Kiribati politician, could face deportation after Parliament rules on the report. So joining us this morning for more on this story is Kiribati reporter Ramon. Ramon, with that, I say good morning.
Good morning, Aggie. How are you doing from your end?
I'm well. Thank you so much, Ramon, for joining us. Look, you've followed the saga, right, for the past 2 years, and obviously with various attempts to deport David Lambourne. Does it look like the government will soon have its way?
I think most likely that's what we're seeing right now. So we're going towards that. I mean, this saga did happen. It actually started well before 2 years ago, or around 2020. And, you know, just interestingly, that all the attempts by the government to remove David Lambourne, this Australian judge, has been unsuccessful so far. And this is through the court medium, the proper court medium, you know. So he survived two deportations attempts by the government. And, you know, he's still trying to seek justice within a proper court system that has a full independence, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So, understandably, there was a tribunal that was set up back in, correct me if I'm wrong, in 2022, and what comes with that is the report. So what does the actual tribunal report say?
Well, the report has, I think just for context, it's important to understand how and when can you remove a judge from a court, right? So there's two options of how to remove a judge, and this is spelled out in the constitution, the Kiribati constitution. The first is of course, you know, when the judge himself is not in a fit or mental state to carry out his duties. The second is if he did some misbehaviors. And now, if he did some misbehaviors, the government or the president rather has a prerogative powers to sort of like establish a tribunal and investigate all these allegations. So what we're seeing here is rather David Lambourne trying to seek justice within the proper court systems, but the government is using the tribunal as, you know, an alternative court to try and judge or perhaps decide on the fate of this Australian judge. So basically, there are five allegations in the report. If you have access to that report, which will be public soon, I think it's quite interesting that such allegations, constitute for a tribunal or the removal of a judge. I mean, there are proper complaints mechanism within the Code of Conduct for judicial officers within the High Court that could deal really. So mainly the substance of these allegations are really sort of petty measures, you know, and that the question now on the ground is it necessary to use these measures to just to remove him, or should they just use the avenues already available within the court system, such as any public servant or any someone working within a government is governed through my code of conduct, you know. So we were seeing this as kind of a very extreme step by the government to remove a high court judge.
Yeah, and with that removal, I'm just wondering, why was there such a rush to get this on the floor of Parliament?
Well, I've been trying to talk with a number of MPs. Some have accorded me their time. Some are still promising me, so I'm here to meet with them. But, you should understand that this is the last meeting for this house, meaning we've come to the end of this term, the 4-year term. And that means by the end of this week, all the MPs, or rather later in the month, will lose their job as MPs, because it comes to an end, this natural end. So people, there will be another run of elections and all this. And so people are seeing it that this government wants to get this done and over with, you know, this campaign. It's been 3 years or 2 years. And so this is the last meeting. And the government, you know, thinks perhaps that this is the last attempt to really get done over with this issue. So I think that's how people are seeing it. I'm still yet to speak with someone from the current ruling party that may perhaps offer a different insight, but most likely this is how things are being positioned and projected at the moment. So this is how we perceive it.
But my understanding is the High Court has said David Lambourn cannot be deported while an appeal is pending. So then does this tribunal report change things?
Well, look, like I mentioned, there's the proper court system, and then now there's a tribunal. So I think how it's looking is that the government seems to be using that avenue. You know, if it can't get the way through the proper court channel, because all of David's cases has been successful with respect to the law. You know, so I think that's the issue. I've had one of our former president say that the government is not wanting to comply with the court system, so it has its own system, which is the tribunal. And so what that means is that all the allegations against David Lambourn won't be heard or decided for in a court of law, but rather be decided through a report that will be debated later this afternoon. And of course, we understand that in parliament the current ruling party has the majority, and so that would ensure David's Lambourn's removal from his more dismissal from his position as a judge of a high court.
I'm wondering also, has David himself said anything publicly about the report and his current situation?
The only time I interviewed David Lambourn was the day they woke him up from his house to deport him straight away into the airport. He did give a statement at that time. Since then, he has recused himself from talking to the media, I think for obvious reasons. But I do try to get in touch with him and understand his side of the whole saga, because it's getting a lot of pressure and attack from the government. But at the moment, no, he said he hasn't really come out to speak with the media.
Okay. Ramon, can I ask though, when are we likely to hear anything from Parliament?
Well, the debate is usually on the motion is usually done in the afternoon. I think that's the current schedule of the parliament meetings, and then from there on. So by the end of this night, by the time people are having dinner, you know, it would be clear that David Lambourn has been dismissed. I think it's a predetermined outcome that we all know where it's coming through. And I think this paves the way for the imminent deportation of the Australian judge, and when and how that will happen is for us to watch and closely.
Absolutely. We will keep our eyes and ears on this story, but we do appreciate your time this morning, Ramon.
No, thank you for having me. Have a good day.
No worries. That, of course, Kiribati reporter Ramon here on Pacific Beat. Let's turn our attention to Samoa, where they've declared a dengue fever outbreak with over 200 cases since November last year. According to the Acting Director General of Health, Atua Glenn Fatupaito, numbers are increasing, with the Apia urban area as one of the most affected areas.
We've seen an upswing of cases, particularly in the last 2 weeks. We recorded 81 cases. And so since we've been monitoring, as you know, dengue fever is endemic to Samoa. So it's always present, but the ministry always keeps a tab on when cases increase exponentially. So we've seen an increase as we've been monitoring since November last year, the trend. So we've declared an outbreak. We're waiting another report, an updated report this Friday, to give us an update what's the numbers like since last week. So there's been 216 cases since November 2023. And within the first 2 weeks of April alone, there's been 81 confirmed cases.
Can you highlight some of the areas that has the highest number of cases?
So we've identified that the northwestern Upolu and Apia urban areas has the highest amount of cases. So these are the cases that come. And keep in mind that these cases are laboratory-confirmed cases. So people come into hospital with symptoms. We take their blood. We test it. So as of yet, there's no testing capability out in the peripheries. So we may be... Well, it's likely that we're seeing a representative of the true picture. But we interview people, where are you from? And so we know, okay, that's how we're gauging our hotspots.
Lovely. Now, in terms of the children, are there many numbers, how are the numbers for children, presenting dengue fever?
Yes, we have seen, we've seen certain spikes in the demographics. So, for example, we've seen spikes in the 5 to 9-year-olds, the 20 to 29-year-olds, and the 60 to 69. So those are the highest numbers we have so far since 2023.
You know, the ministry's current plan at the moment. Can you just state on what the ministry is up to?
Last week, we got the approval from Cabinet. We gave a Cabinet paper, a PICA, seeking a government approval for two things, a nationwide campaign for cleanup campaign. So this was approved on the 17th of April, and so that's how, once we got this approval, we declared an outbreak officially, and we're now working with other partners, Ministry of Women, Ministry of Education. So in short, what we're doing, this Friday, Cabinet has approved a cleanup campaign. So it's a half day for all government workers, half day in the sense that you work in the morning, and then from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, it's cleanup. So every government ministry is requested that they tidy up around their immediate area. So as what we talked about before, you know, looking at areas that water pools, general cleanup, reducing the mosquito breeding sites. And we're also engaging the Suyunuku to clean up campaigns within the villages itself. So it's... think of it, it's a nationwide engagement to tackle dengue fever.
And that's Acting Director General of Health, Atua Glenn Fatupaito, and he was speaking there with ABC's Adele Fruin. Well, early in the show, we heard about the latest from Solomon Islands, where vote counting has been completed. The government forming process is underway, where 26 is the number of MPs needed to form government. With no one grouping holding majority, a coalition will need to be formed to be the country's next government. Helping us to dissect the election result is Australian National University researcher, Dr. Terence Wood. With that, I say good morning, Terence.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well, thank you. Appreciate your time this morning. Look, we know that no one party holds the majority, but now that the dust has settled, how does it look in terms of numbers?
So I guess the party that everyone was interested in, the Our Party, had a bad election, most certainly. They lost 18 of their sitting members of parliament, which means that they had 14 incumbents re-elected plus one new MP. So they got 15 MPs in their party going into negotiations. So it was an interesting election for them. Having said, having pointed out that they had such a bad night, they're still the largest party going into the government formation negotiations.
So as you say, they've only got 15 that have got through. Do you then still feel that they may have a shot at becoming government?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, one of the key features of the current, of the new parliament is that so many independent members of parliament were elected. So many people who weren't affiliated with parties. There was 11 of the 11 independents elected. So all of their votes are basically up for sale. So it wouldn't be too hard for Our to cobble together a coalition with independents and perhaps other smaller parties like Supra or the Cadre Party. So, yes, they've still got a chance, most certainly.
Yeah, because if we look at the opposition groupings, we do have Matthew Wale's Kia Coalition and then Peter Kenny-Larea's United Party. They have about 20. I'm not the best at maths, but mathematically they should be able to get into office. But is it that straightforward, though?
So, yeah, I have them at having 19, so Kia plus United, and they've definitely got a chance. Things are looking better for them than they were before the election. They do face a few challenges, though. The first of those is that it's always a little harder to hold together a coalition in election negotiations than it is to hold together MPs from an individual party. There's no rules that require coalitions to stick together. And so it's easier for figures on the other side of the equation to pry their governing or their coalition with a shared aspiration of changing the government, easier to pry that grouping apart. And it's worth knowing that the other thing which is worth pointing out about the election results is Gordon Darcy Lilo was re-elected. I think for the first time since 2014, he was intriguingly elected in the Central Honiara electorate, and he's a former prime minister. He's also cashed up, and he's a master political manoeuvrer too. So, I mean, a lot's going to come down to just whose side he falls down on and who he decides to help as prime minister.
Well, that'll be it, all right? How will parties be trying to lure in independent MPs who make a significant bulk of these MPs?
So potential prime ministers will have set up camps in differing hotels in different parts of Honiara, and what they'll be doing is they'll be bringing independents and other MPs over to their hotels and offering them enticements to join their coalition. And so those enticements historically have involved either money or promises of power, i.e. you'll become the minister of something or other if you join our coalition. And so that's what will be going on right this moment in Honiara as we speak. It's a difficult process to get a handle on. It's all very opaque, but that's what happens. That's how governments are formed in Solomon Islands after elections.
That's right. I know coalitions are key to forming that next government. But look, I have to ask Terence, would you be able to take a gamble and forecast who could be the next PM?
No, definitely not. The only thing that I will say is that I suspect Gordon Darcy Lilo's odds of becoming Prime Minister are higher than you might think looking at election results alone. I mean, only one person, him, from his party, was elected into parliament. So you might think that he's just a small fry in the coming negotiations, except I suspect he will play a central role and he might use his leverage to actually become prime minister himself. That's not a promise. Other than that, it's sort of anyone's guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we shall wait and see for that. But Terence, it is great to talk with you. Appreciate your time this morning.
No worries. Good to talk.
All right. That is Dr. Terence Wood, researcher with the Australian National University. Pacific delegates are in Ottawa, Canada this week to lead a push for a global treaty on plastic pollution. They're joining more than 2,000 delegates representing member states. At stake is a draft of an internationally binding treaty on dealing with the 350 million metric tons of plastic waste the world creates every year. For more on this, reporter Mackenzie Smith spoke with Vanuatu's ambassador to the UN, Oro Tevi, who is at the talks in Ottawa.
Well, this treaty is very important because the Pacific is faced with a number of challenges, especially the current planetary crisis that we are facing. We have climate change, pollution, as well as biodiversity loss. And for plastics, the Pacific is facing a lot of challenges with plastic, especially its disposal is creating a lot of pollution in the Pacific. We know that most of the plastics that they used around the world are washed into the Pacific Ocean. So that's a major challenge. And they are also consumed by marine life, especially fish. So these are the challenges that we are facing. So the fish we eat contains a lot of microplastics, and the Pacific coastal communities depends on fish a lot for their protein. So it poses a health risk as well to the population of the Pacific, but also to the world, because we rely on tuna resources as well as other fish to export to the world, and we have a responsibility to ensure that the fish that we export to the world are safe and healthy.
And so can you tell me about what Pacific delegates hope to come away with here in terms of the treaty?
We do have current conventions around over three conventions that we have currently that regulate plastics, but they are not adequate enough. So, for example, we have 16,000 chemicals that are known, and only 4% of these chemicals are associated with chemicals are regulated under existing regulations, multilateral regulations. And also, not all countries in the world are party to the multilateral agreements on plastics at the moment. So there's a huge gap there for transparency, disclosure. So I think it's very important that we have a plastic treaty that can cover all these key areas. Where there is a current gap, we need to fulfill this current gap, especially with the current multilateral agreement. So we hope that the current plastic treaty can fill those gaps, but also address other issues that are important.
Negotiations between countries broke down in the previous meeting. What are you hoping will change this time?
Well, it will depend on the negotiations, how far we go, and we have to lobby politically hard, especially with those few countries that may want a treaty that is ambitious. So we have to talk to them and negotiate and trying to find ways to resolve some of the challenges that they are facing, but also for them to understand where we are coming from, especially from the perspective of high ambition countries, which the Pacific is part of. We are trying to be ambitious. So we will have to work on that together with those countries.
And that was Vanuatu's ambassador to the UN, Odo Tevi, speaking there with Mackenzie Smith. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main story today. As the Prime Minister of Australia and PNG take part in the Anzac Dawn service, battlefield historian Mac McLaughlin says the Pacific played an essential role in World War II.
Local people provided absolutely essential assistance to the fighting troops, and we never would have achieved a victory without them, because they knew the terrain, they assisted by carrying in supplies, they carried out wounded people.
Remember, you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. But stay tuned for Radio Australia. News is next. After that, it's Nita Daily. Till next time, I'm Agatha Boyle, and this is Pacific Beat.